Time now for Revolutions Per Minute.
Revolutions Per Minute is a weekly radio show from the New York City chapter of the Democratic Socialists of America. Recorded live at WBAI 99.5 in Brooklyn every Wednesday at 9 p.m. RPM's about doing the work to build a democratic socialist future. Each week, hear the latest news, analysis, and organizing experience from the minds and hearts of activists fighting every day in New York City. Join the movement at socialists.nyc.
Hello, New York. I'm Chris Carr, he and pronouns, and you're listening to Revolutions Per Minute, live from the new WBAI Studios, a socialist radio show and podcast from members of New York City Democratic Socialists of America. The Democratic Socialists of America is the largest socialist organization in the United States, with 95,000 members nationwide, and NYC DSA is its biggest chapter. We are run by our 9,000-plus members and organizers who are working together to build democratic socialism in all five boroughs. In the early hours of the morning on the 15th of September, the Biden administration announced that a tentative agreement had been reached by the railroad companies and the railroad unions, delaying a potential nationwide strike. Now, the decision to accept this tentative agreement or reject it and potentially go on strike rests with the railroad workers themselves. Tonight, we talked to Ross, a locomotive engineer and member of Railroad Workers United, to hear more about what railroad workers really think of this agreement and what may happen next. We also hear from Honda from DSA Labor to learn more about the launch of DSA's National Labor Solidarity Fund and how this fund can help aid working class struggle from coast to coast. We have a great show lined up for you tonight, but first, here are the week's headlines. Local news, the New York City Districting Commission rejected proposed city council redistricting maps set to be implemented next year. The maps had provoked outrage from a number of ethnic and political communities across the city. A bill introduced in the city council would make it so corporations that are repeatedly in violation of the Fair Work Week law would lose their license to operate. A local of DC 37, the city's largest municipal workers union, was put under administratorship by AFSCME after union members made complaints that revealed severe financial mismanagement. Mayor Adams has scaled back plans set in place by his predecessor to expand preschool for three-year-olds to all New Yorkers. Transit advocates rallied for service improvements outside of Barclay Center, calling for six-minute bus and train service at all times. Queens residents and transit advocates are questioning the recent Queensway announcement along an abandoned railroad corridor, asking if reintroducing transit service would have been a better decision. A proposed bill in Albany would guarantee legal help to low-income New Yorkers who face deportation or detention hearings. NYC officials have appealed a judge's ruling to reinstate unvaccinated police officers. City Council is considering legislation targeting improving internet access in an attempt to bridge the, quote, digital divide. In the last fiscal year, more New Yorkers were approved for affordable apartments through the city's affordable housing lottery system. However, the average wait time for approval also increased. NYCHA officials were grilled at a city council hearing for a lethargic response to complaints of cloudy water and possible arsenic contamination. Sewer backups doubled in NYC in the last year, under strain from increased rainfall as a result of climate change. In election news, a big meeting of the Brooklyn Democratic Party devolved into chaos and ended without holding a previously scheduled vote to re-elect party boss Ratneesh Rashad Hermalyn. Our headlines are brought to you by The Thorn, an incredible weekly newsletter by NYC DSA Electoral Working Group, covering local politics and radical activism. Subscribe at thethornnyc.substack.com. Earlier this week, I sat down with Ross, a locomotive engineer and member of Railroad Workers United. We talked about the struggles of railroad workers in their fight for a just contract, and what comes next after the tentative agreement between the railroad carriers and the unions was announced earlier this month. Let's listen in. Hi, Ross. It's great for you to join us here on Revolutions for Minutes. Say hi to the people.
Appreciate being here, Chris.
Something we like to ask all of our guests here at RPM is, first of all, who are you? What do you do? And what were some of the social forces in your life that led you to the railroads and now your advocacy for workers' rights?
My name is Ross Gruters, and I am a co-chair of a crosscraft railroad organization and have done that work since 2015. Railroad Workers United is composed of 12 different members of 12 different railroad unions, as well as solidarity members or community allies. We're a dues-sustaining organization. And then through my employment on the railroad as a locomotive engineer, I'm a member of the Brotherhood of Locomotive Engineers and Traymen, which is one of the operating crafts on the National Freight Railroads. I came by this work because I was looking for a good-paying job that was better than the last job I had. And I had a lot of people that I had worked with who went to the railroad and said that I would enjoy this work. And about 20 years ago, it was more enjoyable work. As I think with all workers in this country, in recent years, we've been asked to do more work faster with fewer people. And that squeeze has made the job really intolerable, and the work hours are demanding. And so because of those things, I have kind of dedicated myself to being a leader within rail labor and trying to move our issues forward and see what we can do to push back against the corporate greed and these rail carriers that are making billions and billions of dollars at our expense.
Yeah, yeah, and I think you brought up a great point about like the changes that have been happening in this industry like over the past couple of decades. This has been seen like across many different sectors across the economy. And for the railroad industry in particular, I know there's been this shift over the past few decades towards what's called like precision scheduled railroading, where like the railroads have been under this increasing levels of consolidation, the shutting down of like the least profitable routes. And with this, you have like these rail cars that stretch for miles. And on top of that, a part of this, like this process to sort of squeeze the railroads, you also have tens of thousands of workers in this sector which have lost their jobs. And the product of this, like you have these railroad companies which are making out like bandits with record profits. And I do think that kind of does connect to this broader story of what's been happening across production towards this more like lean, more just-in-time approach, which has really squeezed workers, and we're seeing that here in the railroad sector.
Yeah, I think that's correct. Anytime the bosses bring you something that has an acronym to it, it's not going to be good for you. So precision scheduled railroading, or PSR, really is what you describe, and it's also the financialization of the railroad or investment capital coming in to try to siphon off as much value to maximize operating ratio, to get to drive shareholder value and get dividend payouts and really capitalize on the railroad profitability in the short term at the expense of the long term. And really what the precision part of precision scheduled railroading is how precisely can we cut this operation to where it's bare bones, bare minimum, And it's very clear now at this point with where we're at in the freight rail system and all the attention that's been brought upon them not being able to deliver a good quality service for the customers who want to ship their goods, is that they cut too deep. They've done harm to the freight rail system. And I don't think we've begun to see all the ramifications. I think we're continuing to see some of the problems because of cuts to maintenance, whether it be equipment or track. And so we're seeing derailments. And it's about, again, I'm an operating craft as a locomotive engineer. I work with a conductor, two people on a single train. Used to be a mile long train was pretty good size. Now they're trying to push those trains 2-3 miles and even longer. Again, fewer people doing more work, and it just creates an unsafe working condition that kind of we all bear the consequences of that, whether or not we work for the railroad or not. One of the things we're really pushing for now is just safe staffing levels and quality of life improvements to kind of correct that trend.
So for our listeners who haven't been following these negotiations between the rail carriers and the railroad unions, perhaps until very recently, and the tentative agreement that came out of the Biden administration's presidential emergency board, could you give our listeners a brief refresher on the nature of these negotiations and some of the major events that led us to this tentative agreement we have now?
Yeah, Chris, we've been without a contract for approximately 3 years now, without a raise. So it's a long time to go without a contract. The reason we've gone that long is because we fall under the Railway Labor Act, which just continues us as workers working under that previous contract. The biggest thing you need to know about the RLA, or that listeners need to know about the RLA, is that it is designed to keep railroad workers working. It's designed to prevent a work stoppage, whether it be a company lockout or a strike. And so because of that, we have some recommendations out of a three-person mediation board that really don't catch up to the changes that we talked about with PSR. I think that the three people that were trying to make those recommendations maybe haven't quite understood where the freight railroads have arrived at compared to where they were at even just a decade ago. We've seen those cuts. About 30% of the workforce has been lost in that decade, even before the pandemic. And so now we're at a point where we have a tentative agreement for several, and I guess this is important to know, there are multiple craft unions on the railroad, each one in a different point in the negotiation process. So as a operating craft, myself and the conductors have a tentative agreement that we're looking at, and we're in a question and answer period, and we'll take a vote on that contract starting the middle of next month and going into the middle of November, and then have results. And ultimately, under the RLA, our fate could be decided by Congress.
Yeah, so I wanted to dig a bit deeper into this new deal from the Presidential Emergency Board. So what in the deal, from your perspective, has improved from the first attempt at a PEP agreement? What in this agreement has stayed the same?
So we've only had one tentative agreement. What the PEB does is it looks at what the carriers want to offer workers and what the unions are asking for from the carriers. And it tries to bring those two positions together to make a recommendation. And the PEB made recommendations, a series of recommendations. As far as I can tell, the biggest changes coming out of that were three unpaid, they call them, they're basically days for medical appointments. There's three unpaid days that railroad workers can use 30 days in advance, Tuesday, Wednesday, or Thursday, for scheduled doctor's appointments. That came out of it, as well as one kind of floating personal holiday, like a birthday holiday. Other than that, I don't think a lot changed from the PEB, other than the tentative agreement is asking us to agree to some very work-specific rules that are a little bit kind of hard to understand, that the biggest thing to understand about them is that they will cut the workforce and have us working even more frequently, but give us a potential 48-hour off period at the end of 5 or 6 days. Again, the problem with those is it continues to lead to staffing cuts. It doesn't address the quality of life and give folks adequate quality time off that they can count on or know to schedule. It didn't bring forth paid sick days. It didn't continue to hold the line on providing affordable health care. It didn't provide cost of living adjustments that keep up with inflation. So there's a lot of shortcomings in the agreement, and this deal that was brokered didn't address a lot of those. In fact, it left a lot of confusion because the work rules still have yet to be negotiated, and we're supposed to vote on this TA sight unseen with the understanding that there's going to be a good faith negotiation and then some kind of binding arbitration to settle those work rules. So it's not a good situation that we're in right now. And machinists in particular have voted down their first tentative agreement and just came out with the second one today. Again, we'll see where the process goes for the other rail unions, including mine.
Yeah, so like with your ear to the street, like from like the people you know and like your conversations you've had like on and off the job with your coworkers and like other members of Railroad Workers United, what's the general mood like amongst the membership?
I think there's a lot of frustration, first with the PEB recommendations, but then with the tentative agreement. And we know as railroad workers that this tentative agreement isn't going to address the issues that give us those quality of life improvements with some time off that we can count on to take care of ourselves and our families. So there's a lot of frustration, disappointment, anger, not a lot of happiness with this agreement. Some people can use the money, of course, going 3 years without a raise in some of the highest inflationary times that we've seen, at least in recent memory, is difficult. But very few people that I've talked to are willing to vote yes. And there's a desire to continue to fight to get what we need as railroaders. And so I don't think we're done yet, but I also know that ultimately under the RLA, Congress can step in and unilaterally impose the terms of an agreement.
So you mentioned like these feelings of dissatisfaction and frustration within people who work on the railroad. And so I want to learn more about Railroad Workers United and what have you all been doing to sort of capitalize on that frustration, to sort of mobilize your fellow workers and agitate within the established railroad unions?
I like that you use the word agitate, because we're very much in a process of the old adage, right? We're organizing, we're educating, we're agitating, and we're pushing for more. What I will say about RWU and our role in that is that in many ways, this is sort of grown beyond just this small cross-craft organization, and that people are sort of self-organizing all over the country and having conversations in text message groups and social media and just kind of working on finding a path forward and kind of sharing their frustrations, but then trying to figure out what we do next. And Railroad Workers United has been working hard to understand this agreement, get information out there to educate members, and then we've held a series of Zoom meetings to try to talk about some of the issues and chart a path forward. What it probably looks like when we're able to make a decision as a steering committee, because we're an organization that kind of follows our bylaws. Well, we do follow our bylaws and works through these issues as a group. Once we get there, it takes a little bit more time for us, but it's looking more and more like we'll try to help facilitate workers' voices and lifting them up for if it's a vote no campaign and that's what folks want to do, that's what they'll do. But that outside organizing is such that, for instance, outside of Railroad Workers United. There were some informational pickets that occurred across the country a week ago Wednesday, and those had hundreds of railroad workers across a few dozen terminals across the country, basically lifting up the needs that we have, telling folks, hey, this agreement, it isn't a done deal, as you mentioned, but also here's what we need, and just laying out those demands about safe staffing levels and safer working conditions, quality of life improvements with time off and paid sick days, affordable health care, and really just focused on those issues to try to say this TA doesn't address those, and so we're still fighting. And so we're seeing a lot of spontaneous organizing, and we're a long ways from voting on being still about 3 weeks out from even seeing the final tentative agreement with any question and answers attached and getting our ballot. We're a ways from that, but I think you'll see more and more as those ballots come out and people start to make up their minds about whether or not they're supportive or not of this agreement.
So I wanted to take a broader view for a moment and sort of recognize that like what we're seeing on the railroads is happening within like a larger environment of this rekindling of worker organizing, if it be at Starbucks or Amazon. And so I wanted to get your thoughts about what this recent spark of working class militancy, and do you think that activity from the outside has influenced your organizing inside the railroads and what workers feel is possible now?
I think in many ways, rail labor is insulated from much of the other labor. There's, of course, we've talked about the RLA and how we're separated by the RLA and share that just with the airline industry. Railroad workers work schedules 24/7, 365. Most people are on call. So there are big differences. And I think the job is so unlike most labor that those connections are slow in coming and hard to achieve. What I will say is, as a member of the Brotherhood of Locomotive Engineers and Traymen, we're members of the Teamsters Rail Conference. And so working with Teamsters, especially locally, learning about how our issues are so interconnected, especially when it comes to safety and issues of scheduling, and finding ways that we can build up, you know, UPS workers are probably the largest block within Teamsters, and they're coming up in 2023 on a similar contract situation where they're going to be negotiating for a contract. And so how can we make those connections and build that solidarity is very important to me and very important to us at Railroad Workers United. It's tougher once you start talking to coworkers who may not have that sort of class consciousness and see those connections just yet. But I'm starting to hear more and more people's desire to kind of build some of that solidarity. And I feel it strongly. I don't feel there's a whole lot of difference between the actual process of my labor compared to other workers. We're all putting our bodies and our time on the line. We're all helping produce the profits, and we all deserve our fair share of those, and we should have good quality life outside of our workplaces. And if we're not getting that, then it's time, as you've mentioned with many service sector jobs, it's time to fight for it.
Yeah, and I kind of like really hope like these really high profile struggles like what we're seeing on the railroads can sort of inspire sort of broader like cross connections of people in different industries and different sectors who do radically different kinds of work, see many of the same problems emerge. So with that, I wanted to get to my final question, which is if listeners want to learn more about Railroad Workers United and stay connected, so are there any links or places where they can go to learn more?
You can go to railroadworkersunited.org. Spelled out railroadworkersunited.org. You're welcome to sign up if you're listening as a Solidarity member for $25 a year. We're a dues sustaining organization to help us do the work and get the word out there. You can also follow Railroad Workers United at Railroad Workers, and that's on Twitter. We have Facebook as well. More than welcome to follow me at Ross Gruters on Twitter, and I continue to share my stories about what it's like to work on the railroad and kind of help bring some of the members of the railroad community and allies into the conversation. So those are some places you can reach us. And then if we do end up on the picket line or locked out, there's probably a rail yard near you that will have folks out picketing. So stay tuned for that.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you, Ross. This has been a wonderful conversation.
Yeah, thank you. Appreciate the time, Chris.
That was my interview with Ross Gruters of Railroad Workers United and the ongoing struggle for a just contract. And just to give some broader context of that interview, Ross joined me after doing a 9-hour midnight shift. And I'm so honored that he would have the time to come on Revolutions for a Minute and actually talk about the ongoing struggles of people who've dedicated their lives to the railroad. So thanks a million, Ross. I really appreciate it. Now, to learn more about what socialists are doing to promote the interests of the working class, we are now joined by Honda. So, Honda, introduce yourself. Say hi to the people.
Hi, everyone. My name is Honda Wang.
And it's so great to have you on. Longtime listeners may recognize Honda as a friend of the show. But for listeners new and old, could you reintroduce yourself to our audience and the kind of organizing you do within DSA?
Absolutely. I am a steering committee member of DSA Labor, our National Labor Commission, which is the primary labor organizing body of the Democratic Socialists of America. I've been involved with DSA for quite a while, and I'm also a rank-and-file activist within my own union, which unfortunately got a little shout-out in the Thorn segment earlier. But at the same time, I'm really excited to be a part of the labor organizing work here in DSA in terms of not just supporting workers, but also building up our organizers in DSA to do the necessary solidarity work they need to do to support class struggle.
So you were in the DC 37, mentioned the headlines, is that what you said?
Yes, that was my particular local that had a bit of a scandal. So I am working very hard connecting rank and file members who are upset about the current situation to hopefully win a stronger and more democratic union.
Yeah, that's right. So I know you were sort of in and out of the studio, but from the little bit you were able to catch with my interview with Ross, do you have any response to what you heard or anything that like really resonated with you?
Well, I just know for a fact Ross is a comrade and involved with DSA Labor as well. And what's absolutely fantastic is that they're so committed to organizing, not just within DSA, but also with their brothers and sisters in the union itself as a rank and file member. And the fact that he's able to do this after a 9-hour midnight shift and continuing to put in this energy into this organizing work is precisely the sort of indefatigable spirit that we absolutely need and need to bring to a fighting labor movement that can win, even greater transformative demands that we want as socialists.
Right. And we'll get to more to this. We'll get back to Honda for a second, but just for a station break. You're listening to Revolutions for Minute on listener sponsor WBAI and NYC Broadcasting at 99.5 FM and streaming on your favorite podcast app. We are talking with railroad workers and their struggle for a just contract and what socialists in DSA are doing to support working class organizing across the country. But before we go on, let's take a moment to recognize that to hear the stories of folks like Ross on the air, talking about the poor labor conditions for railroad workers, the lack of quality of life, the poor health care, and not having time to spend with their families. To hear folks like Honda, who are doing the groundwork organizing for socialism here in New York and abroad, it requires a station. And to have a station, it requires staff, a working studio, rent, electricity, internet, transmitters, and thousands of other things. All of these are necessary to keep coverage like this on the air, but for us to have any of that, we need funds to make it happen. That is why we ask for donations from you, our listeners, to help keep WBAI not only survive, but thrive. WBAI is a non-commercial station. That means we are funded by our listeners, and we need donations to keep shows like Revolutions Per Minute on the air, so we can keep making content like this. After the announcement of the tentative agreement between the railroad carriers and the unions, the popular press was silent. The story, I think, quickly left the headlines. They may have thought the story was over, but because of non-commercial media like our own and other outlets that uplift the workers' perspective, we know that it's not only over, but it's the workers who have the final say. And if you're listening at home and you want to hear more from folks like Ross and are inspired not only by the struggle of railroad workers, but workers organizing across the country, then please don't hesitate to give to the station. It would be greatly appreciated if you believe in the work we do here at WBAI and you have the ability to donate monthly, then please consider being a BAI buddy. Anything you give to the station, even a little bit, from everyone listening now, can build into something great. Because in the end, that's what it's all about. To give to the station, please call 212-209-2950. I'll say it again. That's 212-209-2950. Or go to WBAI.org. Thank you. Now, Honda, your work you've been doing with DSA labor for some time now, it's been recently been like a very high time for those who love labor in DSA, because DSA labor recently launched its National Labor Solidarity Fund on Labor Day. So I wanted you to sort of explain what this fund is and what were some of the conversations like behind the scenes that were really trying to make this fund a reality.
Absolutely. So simply put, DSA's National Labor Solidarity Fund is a collective resource for every DSA chapter to draw upon so they can help support workers in local strikes, union drives, and other forms of working class struggle. And so it's been very hard, I think, for chapters to evenly fundraise for these types of organizing efforts. And I think this drew from the positive experience that we had in New York City DSA fundraising around the Teamsters Local 202 strike up at the Hunts Point Produce Market. And we figured, you know, every DSA chapter should have access to a resource like this, regardless of their size or organizing experience, as well as the organizing skills and resources to draw upon as well from our experienced members. And so recognizing that this was a particularly good moment for labor organizing, and a particularly exciting one, we put together this Solidarity Fund's idea together pretty quickly in order for us to be able to ensure that socialists aren't just tweeting about strikes, but all being out there on the picket line, supporting workers and connecting with them. We recognize that this is sort of also an important part of our political strategy too, because we're not just supporting workers like you would cheer someone on running a marathon. It's about offering meaningful solidarity to workers that are in a struggle, right? To show them there exists a broader movement that includes them as workers, to educate them about their own power as workers when they win their strikes, and to give workers the confidence and the cohesion to fight and win real power in our society. For so long, workers have been separated, atomized, and demoralized. And when they start standing up and fighting back, especially in the form of strikes, which attack the key conflict in capitalist society between workers and the owning class, I think that's when we can see some really exciting things start to develop. So this is not just something that was responsive to the exciting labor moment, but about something building up towards something that's a part of a larger political strategy that we have as democratic socialists of America.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think what's like really amazing like about this fund is that since it's at the national level, it's kind of like this big like resource that all chapters that can have access to. And it's not really subject to, I think, a lot of the sort of inhomogeneities in resources that are currently present between certain chapters. Because you have chapters like New York City DSA, which may be quite large, you may have access to resources that a lot of chapters, say, like out in Kansas or Iowa, would not have proper access to. So it's really these funds that really give that sort of equitable ability for these funds to engage in projects that are still unique to their area and be able to contribute on that very micro level by having access to this general fund.
Yeah, I think something so important is that we need to get across DSA as a national organization. You know, we are a collective group of people across this entire country working towards a common goal of socialism. And chapters that maybe are not as developed, maybe they don't have a strong experience in labor organizing, or they don't have the capacity to do fundraising, we can all pitch in together and work together to build up everyone's capacity. And one example I can give is that a lot of times people say, you know, it's just so hard to organize the South, or, you know, it's just so hard to organize right-to-work states. But from my point of view, there are worker struggles happening all across the country in every town. And whether or not, you know, they are, you know, maybe officially a part of a union, maybe they're just doing like a walkout from like a local grocery store or something over inhumane conditions, DSA members should be out there to support them and to cohere the workers' understanding of their own power in our economy. And so this fund, it's not just, you know, a sack of money to take from, but it comes with organizers, people who are part of what we're calling the DSA Labor Corps, who are experienced rank and file union organizers, experienced DSA members who have done labor solidarity work. You don't have to be a union member to be involved with this sort of organizing, but we do want to bring in folks who have that experience of, you know, walking the picket line and understanding what we need to do to be good trade unionists and good community supporters, and bringing that experience and spreading that experience all across the country in all these different DSA chapters as well.
Yeah, so could you give like a sort of real world example of like what kind of work this fund could contribute to in practice, and how could also support the struggles of, say, like railroad workers who could potentially find themselves on the picket line soon?
Absolutely. This is very near and dear to me because I facilitated a strike support panel at the Labor Notes conference this year. And so we got to connect with people all across the country in terms of what it meant for them to receive strike support from community members, as well as all the great stories from DSA members, because virtually everyone doing strike support from that panel was a part of DSA as well. And so in terms of like a real world example, I think, well, first I want to give like three different levels of how we're engaging using this fund. Like at the national level, as I mentioned, we have Labor Corps. At the local level, we have chapter development. So, you know, increasing the labor organizing capacity of our members at the chapter level. And at the level of the labor movements, we're also trying to increase the consciousness of workers involved in struggle, to bring them into our fight for socialism as well. So we can struggle and win, not just, you know, a contract together, but also hopefully important socialist wins in the future as well. And so when it comes to, you know, concrete things that people can do, there are some great examples that DSA chapters have already done and that we want every chapter to be able to aspire to do so and to engage in as well. So, for example, East Bay DSA in California had this amazing program called Bread for Ed, which was not just simply showing up to the picket lines, but they were literally fundraising for meals for teachers, for students. They were coming together in order to show that there's a level of community support that meaningfully empowered teachers, to show that, you know, the community was coming together around them, that, you know, the strike wasn't hurting the students because they were still getting meals, they were still getting engagement from the broader community, but that the strike was about winning a stronger contract and stronger policies at the school to help kids in the long term in terms of their education. I looked at chapters like Portland DSA that did amazing work for striking Nabisco workers. They were literally doing things that union workers were not able to do, and as community members. I don't know how deep into detail I can get into what exactly they did, but it was absolutely fantastic in what they were able to do to show solidarity, to show that, you know, we weren't going to accept scabs walking into the plants, not being told that, you know, they were doing something really terrible, that just showed that the community stood with the workers and stood with them. What was absolutely great that came out of that strike was that a lot of the workers involved in that strike, you know, got to know DSA members. They got to know, learn about DSA, and some of them even joined DSA afterwards as well, because they saw what we were able to do for them. And the last example I will give is a New York City DSA. As I mentioned earlier, we came out really strong for Teamsters Local 202. This was a strike that was over in a matter of days. When I first went on, came to the picket line in the Bronx, I was there with three other DSA members, and we said to each other, we had to get everyone out here. And what we did is that we took the community support from just showing up with donuts and coffee to having a full solidarity kitchen, serving hot meals to workers 24/7 to ensure that they stayed warm by bringing them firewood in this cold December nights, because that picket line was going 24/7. And we had the most amazing moments of solidarity come out of that strike. They turned away an entire freight train full of produce because a Teamster was driving that train. Workers told us after the strike that, you know, there's this one worker, I'm going to quote him here, said, "I've been quiet for the past few years, but I'm not going to be quiet anymore." The workers learned that they had power and they were able to exercise it. And so those are some of the concrete examples that I hope that we can bring every DSA chapter up to be able to perform. And for the railroad workers, as you know, things are in a bit of a holding pattern right now, but we are ready to hit the ground running if there's a lockout, if there's a strike. You know, I think we have gone past the days when we can expect at most a statement of support for workers. I think now, especially at our level of organization and with the support of a fund like the Labor Solidarity Fund we have at DSA, we're able to actually cohere an entire organizing body, get people on the ground, and get people doing real organizing, doing real solidarity work. That's more than just words, but actions.
Yeah, and I can give an example from my life as well. Being a grad student at Columbia, the Union Student Workers of Columbia, which is part of the UAW, when we had like our major grad strike early last year, DSA was with us from the beginning. They were walking the picket lines with us. They showed up to our rallies. They showed up to our Zoom calls, and I think they were there. I think before a lot of the news really caught up to what was happening at Columbia. And even though I was already a member of NYC DSA by the time, it only reaffirmed I think a lot of my goodwill in towards the branch as far as like really developing that connection between the socialist movement and academic labor. That was something that thing really struck me at that moment. So we have like this new National Labor Solidarity Fund. How does it sort of fit inside the patchwork of the other projects that DSA Labor has been actively doing?
Absolutely. So with I keep mentioning the Labor Corps, and it's so important because we are actively cohering this body right now in terms of being able to build its capacity. Like eventually, I have like high hopes of being able to send DSA members who are part of the Labor Corps out to like picket lines and out to strikes. We already have people who do this on their own. For example, we have like two rank and file members of the nursing union here in New York City. They flew out to UW-Madison for the nurses' strike out there to connect with nurses that they had met at Labor Notes and support them in that way. I myself flew back to my hometown in Iowa to connect with John Deere workers who are on strike, and I made a good friend, Nolan Tabb, who is an important rank and file leader and UAWD, or Unite All Workers for Democracy, the Reform Caucus in the UAW. And all these experiences, I think, will lead to something really really exciting out of DSA labor. For so long, you know, we've sort of been on the sidelines of the labor movement. I think the labor corps will allow us to be really become a part of it in a meaningful way, shoulder to shoulder with those workers, not just, you know, as supporters, but so much of the labor corps that we're trying to recruit are also rank and file workers. And so related to that is, you know, our Starbucks solidarity work. That's been sort of a big campaign that we've been running for the past year. And we know that so many stores have won their elections already, but the company is refusing to recognize the union. They're refusing to bargain in good faith. They continue to union bust. They continue to illegally fire workers or retaliate against union organizers. And so we expect more strikes to be announced in the near future. We expect more actions to be announced that maybe not strikes, maybe they're walkouts, maybe they're protests. But all in all, we want to be able to sufficiently support those efforts across the entire country, because this is one of the biggest new organizing drives, one of the highest profile organizing drives. And it's so important for these workers to win a contract from Starbucks. We also continue to involve DSA members with EWOC projects that have gone public. As you know, EWOC, or the Emergency Workplace Organizing Committee, is a joint project between DSA and the UE Union. And they help you organize at your workplace through steps, you know, 0 through 50 before they refer you to a union if you want to unionize your workplace and, you know, have a proper NLRB election. And a way for us to continue to be a part of their organizing, not just as EWOC volunteers, but also as community supporters, because when they go public, they also need that community support to show them that we stand in solidarity with them, and that the boss can't intimidate them when we're all collectively working together. And as Ross had mentioned at the end of his interview, next year, the UPS contract fight is going to be a big nationwide fight. And our very active logistics committee has been furiously organizing around that. And we expect the Solidarity Fund to play such an important role in this nationwide strike. The last time UPSers struck in 1997, you know, they helped shut down the entire U.S. economy. Over 80% of all ground deliveries were interrupted, and it was a massive show of force by these workers. And it means so much that they win a strong contract, whether or not they go on strike, because so much of the logistics industry is looking to UPS right now. At this UPS facility in Queens that I recently visited for a contract rally, one of the some Amazon workers swung by to talk to the UPSers and to sort of see what was happening with the rally. And they were building a brand new Amazon facility right next to that UPS facility in Queens. And so if UPSers go on strike, they give a show of force and they win a strong contract. If all that aligns and they can do that in a really strong way, that can really propel, I think, organizing in different sectors and in different companies like Amazon. It can show workers that when you come together, when you fight together, you can win. And I think that's an incredibly important message for us to continue to support and actively contribute to as well.
You've been listening to Honda from DSA Labor joining us to talk about the launching of the National Labor Solidarity Fund. If you would like to join the conversation, now is your time to shine. If you have a question for me or Honda, or about railroad workers and their contract fight, please call us at 212-209-2877. Again, that number is 212-209-2877. Please join us. We'd love to talk to you and hear your thoughts. So while we wait for any calls to come in, I want to sort of step back a little and really address like a more of like a fundamental question of like, why is it important that socialists have this deep connection with the labor movement? Like, why is that such a high priority for DSA?
Yeah, I think in the past, you know, 100 years ago, socialists were often, you know, workplace leaders too. They were union leaders, right? The radicals helped organize workers into a collective force that went beyond just workplace fights and into the political world. And I think that's less common today. We've seen the sort of divorce between workers' movements, the labor movement, and the socialist movement. And we need to reunite these movements together because they need each other in order to grow their power and to be able to win what they really want, which is ultimately power for workers in our economy. If we don't do that, if we stay separated, I think we continue to weaken ourselves because unions will not have as an expansive and ambitious plan for what they want to win. If they just focus on, you know, winning narrow contract fights or doing concessionary bargaining, they're not going to be able to get to the point where they're able to grow like they used to. And they're going to decline, as we saw in the 70s and 80s, and continue that decline. And so it's so important for socialists to unite with workers in that way. And it's also important for workers to power the socialist movement, because fundamentally, we are a working class movement. That's how we fight the capitalist class. And if we lose that character, if we lose that guiding North Star, workers are the source of our power, then I don't know if we're going to be able to win what we really want, which are these transformative demands that demands, you know, a drastic change in our society.
Yeah. So are there any calls before we move on?
No, I'm afraid not.
Okay, great. Well, I guess with our few minutes here on Revolutions Per Minute, Honda, it's been great to have you on. If listeners want to learn more about DSA Labor or donate to the National Labor Solidarity Fund, where can they go to do that?
They can head to laborsolidarity.com. That's pretty straightforward. And you, from there, you can learn about the Solidarity Fund and you can see more details about what we're able to do with the donations. But if you want to give us money straight away, you can just go to donate.laborsolidarity.com. And we really appreciate any sustaining donors. If you can become a monthly donor, not just to us, but also to WBAI as well. If you can afford the change, that'd be much appreciated.
Yes, absolutely. Donate to WBAI. Earlier today, we heard from Ross Scooters from Railroad Workers United talking about the struggle of railroad workers and their contract fight with the railroad carriers. And then now we have Honda from DSA Labor talking about the recent launch of the National Labor Solidarity Fund and all the other incredible activity that DSA Labor is doing right now. So I guess we've got about a minute left, Honda. Is there anything else you want to say before we close out?
I'm honestly just so thankful for the workers who are out in struggle right now, who are, you know, working these inhumane shifts, not being able to see their loved ones, not being able to get the care that they need, just meeting the basic necessities of life. And it's so important to me personally that they're able to get a decent contract from this fight. I know the chips are stacked against them due to federal legislation, which singles out railroad workers because of the vital role they play in our nation's infrastructure. And you know, this comes from a long history of labor struggle, even before the modern labor movement. You know, this goes all the way back to situations like the Pullman strike. And the struggle then. And so to connect the militancy that American workers experienced then, if we can continue to brew that militancy, if we continue to nurture it and grow it, I think we can make real changes in our society. And so all power and all solidarity with those workers who are in struggle right now.
I think that's a great way to close out. You've been listening to Revolutions Per Minute on listener-sponsored WBAI and NYC Broadcasting at 99.5 FM and streaming on your favorite podcast app. To connect with us after the show, you can email us at revolutionsnyc@gmail.com. You can find us on our website, revolutionsperminute.simplecast.com, or on Twitter at NYCRPM. Thank you, New York, for joining us for the hour, and we'll see you next week with more content here at Revolutions Per Minute, ushering in the socialist future. Thank you. Have a nice night.